You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Karsibayev.
All right. Hello, listeners to the Ivy Podcast. Hey, my name is Richard Outram, Chief Financial Officer of Sinch Home Services. We're a leading provider of home services solutions here in the U.S., and our vision is a Sinch home solution in every U.S. household. A bit of personal background, in the finance arena for about 35 years, across multiple organizations in various industries and ownership structures, private public companies and private equity companies, a CFO. I think my elevator speech would be simply this: is I help companies get to the next level of growth and realize their exit strategies. And that's not an easy undertaking. And I'm sure as John and I get more into the conversations here, you'll see why understanding that life cycle is very, very important. So I'm very thrilled to be here, John, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, that's awesome, Richard. Thanks for finding time. Really appreciate you jumping on with us on the Ivy Podcast today. How long you've been with Sinch Homes now?
Just over 4.5 years now. Interesting story there, John. It's a tale of two cities, really a turnaround, but also an amazing transformation. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about what the industry holds for us and what that transformation means.
That's great. Can't wait to get into that with you. And the company, is it based where, here, South Florida, or where at?
It is. It's based in Boca Raton. We've got three locations. Our head office is in Boca Raton. We've got, two contact centers, one in Sunrise in South Florida and one in Anderson, South Carolina. And then we've got various, presence in nearshore, offshore presence as well with some of our contact center agents.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And a little bit of on the personal side, where are you from originally? Are you from South Florida? Whereabouts? Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
John, that's a funny story. If you can't tell by now, I usually give people three guesses on that one. And it's usually somewhere between England, South Africa, or Australia. So I'm born and raised in the UK, immigrated to the US in 1992. So there's a slight twang to my accent. This is why it confuses people. And I left the UK 31 years ago, but I'm from across the pond, so to speak, John.
That's awesome. That's great. That's great. Great stuff. So Richard, you've briefly mentioned in your introduction something to the extent of the business transformation, some transformation strategies that as part of your elevator pitch, you really help companies transform. So being with Sinch Homes for quite some time now, I'm pretty sure you've led those initiatives from the business transformation perspective. Can you tell us a little bit more in terms of what are the key strategies that you had implemented that has led to some of the successful outcomes with that business transformation initiatives?
Well, thank you for that question, John. So I would start off by saying it started off being a bit of a turnaround situation. Thankfully we're a private company. We didn't have, a stock price to kind of uphold and private equity debt and so forth. So we had some latitude to do the right things by the company, even though, it was a turnaround situation. So, it was a typical management tactics. We really had to, 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, really had to clarify the strategy of the company and get a really clear vision as to where we're headed and align the teams around that, both the executive team, which we essentially recapitalized, but also the entire team, and drive the typical blocking and tackling around not only alignment but holding accountabilities, setting the right priorities and the goals. And the prioritization point was a very big one, because when you're in that mode of growth, our top line was growing but our bottom line was kind of suffering. You've got multitude of initiatives that you want to take on, which drive multiple projects as well. So prioritization was a big point of that. I would say, though, John, one of the biggest tactics in that turnaround phase, and I'll get onto the transformation phase in a minute, was really about hiring the right folks. And when you're in that, I like to call it the kind of whitewater phase, you're a $500 million company, very entrepreneurial. You're in this kind of loss indemnification business, because we're in the quasi-insurance business where, we'll have, home warranty policies and people can claim against those and we will repair and replace appliances, HVAC, and so on in the home. So you're kind of a bit of a risk-averse company because you have to be, very akin to the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say finding the right talent, Jan was a real critical part of this. And why do I say that? There are not many people who can operate in that size of that business, in a business that's looking to really transform itself. You have to one day be at 200 feet, you know, essentially heading strategy, and you've got to be 2 inches from the ground on an Excel spreadsheet. And that was very, very difficult to find. We are very rigorous with our interview process because you're going to find, it's not a charisma, you're going to find folks who come from larger organizations who, you know, build empires and so forth. It's where we want to get to, because right. We want to double in size in the next 3 to 4 years. But there's this entrepreneurial spirit you want to keep.
Mm-hmm.
And so managing that kind of talent pipeline is an extremely important part. What I would say to you in terms of the transformation is, even though we tactically had to focus on gross margins, profitable contracts, we doubled down and invested in digital transformation to take costs out of business, even though there were tough times, right, for us. And that has really played us right, John, I would say. I would say, you know, in addition to that part of really kind of knuckling down and really understanding kind of the financial realism of this business, not only the strategic resilience, but also the financial realism, that was very, very important for us.
Right.
You know, we had to focus on KPIs and key numbers and leading metrics and so forth to drive us there. But in addition to that, what I would say, John, which was a real savings grace, is this industry really flourished with the advent of smart technology, IoT, and so forth. So whilst we operated 5 years ago in a $4 billion industry, today we operate in a $450 billion industry in the home services industry.
Right. Wow.
It's a tremendous transformational opportunity to be able to play in that space, not only with home warranty, but DIY and preventative maintenance, and as I mentioned, smart technology and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tremendous opportunity for us, John. So we're on that path. The digital roadmap is a significant part of our transformation, as is top line opportunities with large companies, affinity players, the real estate division. We've got direct to consumer and other verticals that really play in our space. So I'm sure we're going to get into more of that, but that's the kind of turnaround to transformation and a big opportunity ahead of us.
Right. Well, I love that. And I love how you categorized almost the different stages or the you know, the iterations of the transformation, where you start with people. At the end of the day, I come from a, you know, I'm technologist by trade. I come from IT backgrounds, and we always hear these great buzzwords like digital transformation. You know, advanced technologies. But at the end of the day, all of that first starts with people transformation. You know, you can't do digital transformation unless the people that bought in, unless you have the right people on board. So I can relate, and I love what you were saying, that your transformation strategy really starts with people, getting the right people on board, selecting the right people, those who are bought into the overall vision. And then you move on to, you know, the digital transformation aspect or whatever else is part of the organization. So that's pretty cool. I love that. And I love that kind of the multi-phased approach from that standpoint.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you.
And I definitely want to get into a little bit more as far as that, the interview and the selection process, because I think that, you know, that's a topic that's very exciting for me. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the latest trends or the innovation strategies or, you know, the different ideas that are very exciting, at least to you. So from your industry perspective, and you also being, you know, the financial thought leader in this space, what are the most exciting or kind of the innovative technology trends out there that really excite you, or something that you would actually think about, you know, investing in or, you know, implement at your organization?
Right. Great question, John. Thank you. And to answer that question, let me start a little bit by talking about how we've really tried to institute an innovative culture, because it's not easy. Everyone says that, right? It's in every single magazine you talk about, right?
It's everywhere. And it's funny that, sorry to interrupt you, but I just hosted the executive roundtable yesterday on that specific theme alone, just how to build and foster a culture of innovation. And so many cool ideas came out of this. So I came, you know, I'd love to hear your take on that, which I'm pretty sure we could turn into the whole like episode on its own.
Absolutely, John. And think about the story I just mentioned, when you were kind of in this turnaround mode, you're somewhat focused and myopic on you know, turning the financial engineering of the business around, right? Mm-hmm. And so you really don't think about innovation. But as that journey started to kind of progress, we really had to think about how do you innovate in an industry which is, back to my point, kind of risk averse. It's like the insurance industry. Mm-hmm. They almost act like dinosaurs, right? They go very, very slow, and they're always thinking about claims and losses and how they manage risk and so forth, you know?
Right.
And we're a bit in that world. And so you got to say to yourself, okay, you're trying to, you know, manage the financial part of your business, but you also want to start to think about this brand new world of 450 billion out there. And it has not been easy, John. It's not been easy. You know, for us, it starts with the front line. These are folks in the, you know, the day-to-day in the trenches with our customers and our service providers, people who really have the feet on the street. And what we really try to do is, you know, really start to think about, you know, where are the gaps that could really fulfill the customer need, you know, and the customer experience, right? Uh-huh. And just some little bits, we don't have to go too much into this, but things like an idea factory, where, you know, just, you know, quantity of ideas, because sometimes, you know, those ideas that may not seem like the right ones today become the greatest ones tomorrow, right? And then we try to kind of spruce up the idea factory as well by having some competitions. Mm-hmm. All the way to a couple of months ago, we had a simulated Shark Tank competition. We had folk break out into cross-functional groups, develop a business plan, and come in front of the executives, and we tried to reenact the Shark Tank. And it was a beautiful thing because these ideas came from left field and they were very implementable.
Uh-huh.
So it's a journey. I wouldn't say we've mastered the art of, you know, an innovative culture, but we're getting there where we're constantly trying to seek, you know, that ideation and encourage people that the idea doesn't have to be fully thought out. We can start mm-hmm. to think about MVP at the first step and then think about refining it later on. And we try to do it in sprints and iterations. Mm-hmm. But as regards your question about what's the innovation in this industry, it is tremendous. It is tremendous. I would say the whole digital experience on an app in our industry, from a customer being able to sign on, you know, look at their bills, all the way to the journey of where their claim is in the life cycle, mm-hmm. including, let's say, a GPS when the working mother is off running errands with the kids and is waiting a full day for the plumber to come to the house. Right. Now it's simple things like we know exactly where he is, when he's going to be there, and you can kind of, you know, you could, you know, allocate your time properly, all the way to machine learning and AI, which mm-hmm. is very, very powerful for us, because now it's become to the point now where we're looking at technologies, John, where, you know, the video into the home, rather than sending a service provider out there, there could be some early diagnostic.
Right.
Right. And so age of the appliance, age of the HVAC, you know, the electrical system, et cetera, you know, a scan of the home can start to, you know, do some early diagnostics and some very quick DIY before you send out a service provider.
Uh-huh.
All right. And so it's really neat technologies like that. That occur all the way through the kind of digital experience, right? For us, for example, John, one of the biggest heartaches is we've got to triangulate a customer, you know, cinch, as well as the service provider out on the street. All right, we've got to kind of diagnose it on the phone. We've got to figure out what happens, and then we've got to send a person out there. It may take days to get the part, et cetera. All of that now, John, is machine learning and AI now, right?
Right.
We can do some early stuff. Our dream in life as a home services company is same day, next day, perhaps, right? Is to be able to get up to John's house the very next day and fix the plumbing. I'm sure that would be a dream for you, because, you know, nowadays you don't see that.
For sure.
So for us, there's a great multitude of technologies for us that will really kind of aid the efficiency
uh-huh.
and take costs out the systems as well.
Right, right. Absolutely. I love that. And, you know, just to add a little bit on top of what you were talking about from standpoint of advanced technologies is, you know, the like RPA, robotic process automation, with a lot of, you mentioned claims, you mentioned that kind of that repetitive process that as an industry you guys experience that hasn't had quite been innovated or, you know, improved up until, you know, I guess these days. And technologies such as RPA can easily take on a lot of those repetitive tasks and be able to automate a lot of those cool things. So I would imagine there's quite a few products and services that are being developed these days that you guys can definitely, you know, implement and take advantage of.
The other thing I want to add John, which may not be apparent, is, you know, the warranty space has been kind of been fairly narrow. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Home Depots of this world, you go to the Best Buys and you know, these large big boxes, you know, home warranties has been kind of confined to home warranty type companies. But now you have extended warranties within those big boxes. Right. They've all kind of caught on to the fact that there's a beautiful thing when you, and it could be very, very profit proposition for them if you can cover the whole home. So when a service provider is in a home, either with the Geek Squad or through us or whoever, and they're in the home and they've got this radar screen that they can look around the house, mm-hmm. and see that the TV needs to be mounted or it needs to be fixed over here, or the Nest thermostat needs to be repaired or whatever that may be. Just think of the possibilities when that person's in your house.
Oh yeah, right.
And so now the digital technologies will enable not only an on-demand transaction, but there could be upsells and cross-sells now.
Right.
Once that person's physically in them. So for us, there are a multitude of opportunities, John. It's tremendous. Mm.
I can only imagine. And it's, you know, it's also looking from a perspective of how do we prioritize these great ideas and, you know, what's the biggest, you know, impact from the ROI standpoint that we can implement. And it sounds like you guys have a lot of initiatives in place, at least within your company, that produces some ideas from like very, you know, just MVP stage. That's something that we could implement, you know, relatively quickly and take advantage of, rather than going through, you know, endless cycles of looking at a product that's going to take years to implement. So kind of, I love that mentality. I think it's very startup like, you know, approach to a lot of the things that could be improved within a larger organization.
And you have to be, John, you've got to be agile, yeah. because the world is moving on and we've got some serious competition, not only with our immediate competitors, but you know, tech upstarts who are understanding this space and how big it is. And they're moving quickly, yep. with some of these digital, you know, innovations. So yeah. We have to move quickly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To shift gears a little bit, I want to talk about some of the challenges or even best practices or ideas that you had implemented through this current period, you know, through pandemic. It's obviously, you know, a very different time for everybody. Different organizations adapt their processes. Everyone had to, you know, the biggest one, obviously, going full of remote for a lot of organizations. And as a leadership, I talk to a lot of executives on, you know, almost on daily basis, whether that's part of my work or part of the podcast. And it's always interesting to hear different perspectives of how even the leadership styles had to be adapted to, you know, to be leading organizations remotely. Nobody planned for this. And it's a perfect example of kind of that operational resiliency and having a lot of those things in place to be able to weather, you know, times like this. So Richard, from your standpoint as a CFO, you basically, you know, being in charge of all of the financial kind of outlook of the overall organization, such as Cinch Homes, what have been kind of some of the biggest challenges for you through this period so far? And how did you address those?
Great question. And it's a playbook that you'll see in most companies as well, right? We're no different. But what I would say, John, is that the movement to work from home was a very interesting case study for us because, you know, from a leadership standpoint, I would say we're probably in the middle as regards our philosophy and culture around work from home pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got, you know, some big brick and mortar call center, so to speak, you know, as I said, one here in South Florida and one in South Carolina. And we've got, you know, up to, you know, 800 employees, right, which are captive. And we've got a couple hundred thousand, which are outsourced. And if that wasn't our philosophy, all of a sudden now on March 15th, we're forced to spread out like ants now, right, and make this thing work. I can tell you, John, we didn't miss a beat. We did not miss a beat. We were able to light that up. And part of this was we always had a very good business continuity plan because we live in hurricane zone here. Mm-hmm. And so the discipline of kind of lighting that up and having, you know, rhythms and prioritization around that was kind of born in us over years and years and years, right?
Right.
But as regards COVID, when it hit us, we were able to kind of farm out 750 people to 800 people.
Wow.
And miss a beat from a technology standpoint. And we kept the cadence of a daily, you know, huddle and took every functional area of the business and had report outs. And of course, in this environment, like in most companies, you've got to get granular. You've got to understand the leading indicators and lagging indicators, both quantitative and qualitative. And so, and then of course, the big ticket items is, you know, is we had to get into cash preservation mode, like every other company. We weren't sure whether this is a U-shape or V-shape recovery, how long it lasts. And you've only got so much, you don't have infinite resources to be able to do that. So we kicked into that mode. I would say, you know, our industry was a very interesting one because even though, like most companies in our industry, you know, our top line faced a lot of pressure because call centers closed down, marketing campaigns, mm-hmm. our affiliate partners shut down, door-to-door selling shut down as well, right? And a lot of our businesses through large affiliates, you know. But what I would say is what we saw is on the kind of claim side, it was the kind of opposite. Uh-huh. It kind of negated that because during a lockdown, you know, families weren't kind of comfortable letting service providers in. And so it would only be high repairs. Mm-hmm. There was this element of pent up demand as people weren't allowing these folks to come in. But when the kind of lockdowns begin to kind of soften, all of a sudden there was this huge pent up demand in terms of claims, right? And the frequency around that. And then, of course, what we saw, John, was now you're in the home for 6 or 7 months. Mm-hmm. Your family's at home now and they're cooking more. And now the cookware is breaking down and you know, your appliances are breaking down. So for us, we saw some significant lift in terms of not only the frequency of the claims, but all the severity. So it hit us from that side. And companies in our industry have faced that. What I would say, though, on the other side of this is now people are at home more. Now people really understand the value proposition of a home warranty. Mm-hmm. Now you're surfing the web more and going to more of kind of direct to consumer, you know, comparisons, right? And so there is for us now people at home and seeing the value of this, because this is now you pay $600 a year for a home warranty plan, but the average, you know, US household can't afford a $400 repair, right, let alone a $1,000 replacement. So the value proposition has become very apparent to them now, right? So we'll see what the world means for us. But, you know, we've had to pivot in many ways, John, to meet the mm-hmm. the new COVID environment. And we're not done. We have to be very agile in our financial planning and operational planning. We've got to think about what's next along the way. You know, the old days of an annual budget and perhaps a couple of forecast years, basically those days are gone now. We're constantly looking at key leading drivers of this business, right? Mm-hmm. I would say to your point, where's the biggest challenge? You've got to communicate that. You've got to remain calm.
Right.
But, you know, in my seat, in all of this, you've got lives that health is the number one priority, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, they all want to, you know, they all want to be productive and have a job and so forth. And so when you're talking about some of the financial challenges of the business, you know, your words can move oceans, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so you've got to be very, very careful. You've got to be transparent, but you've also got to be very careful and calm about how you're messaging that and absolutely being realistic about it. But the way you deliver that is very, very important, John, is what I would say, you know?
Got it. Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks for those examples. And you guys in a very interesting space where you guys obviously saw an opportunity and definitely trying to capitalize on that, where, you know, the pandemic shifted everyone home, and for obvious reasons, people now utilizing their appliances or whatever other products a lot more extensively. And I think for you guys to pivot and really kind of look at it from that positive, really opportunity standpoint is, you know, it's you know, obviously that's attributed to the solid leadership style or the leadership strategies that are in place, because unfortunately these days we hear a lot of companies going into this kind of almost this like perseverance mode and the kind of this belt tightening mode. And unfortunately, you know, it's a mentality. It's a state of mind, the way I view this. And if you're in this state of mind of perseverance, that's what you're going to get. You're only going to get, you know, this basic survival. You're going to get basic survival, you know, ideas. It just cripples the innovation. It just cripples the growth. And it just shifting from that overall mindset, I think it's, you know, something that you were touching upon as part of what you were going through this period so far.
No, absolutely, John. You raise an absolutely great point, because in amongst all of that, I kind of mentioned at the beginning, is we actually were so laser focused on what our strategy was, even though, you know, we had to go through a bit of belt tightening on discretionary spend and so on. But we doubled down on our investments, on our strategic imperatives. And we actually invested quite a lot in terms of our digital transformation, our direct-to-consumer channels and new innovative channels that are out there, we actually doubled down. And we had support from the board. And so we know when this is all over, we may be a step ahead of others, you know? I would say that. And the other thing I would say, John, to your point, which I should have mentioned earlier, was you've got to demonstrate, and you've got to really mean, you know, a healthy dose of compassion. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in this mode and you're in, a mode of, you know, whether it's tight belting and uber focused on what you need to do, you have to remember that the work from home situation is not easy for many people, right?
Right.
They miss the personal touch. They miss their teams and so on. Right. And you start to see the sentiment more towards that now after 7 months of being at home now. Right. It was a novel idea for a lot of people. But as time wore on, they missed that personal touch.
Yep.
You've got to try to reenact, and you've got to really understand and be empathetic and compassionate about people's lives and what they have to go through. And the fact that people need that human touch. And right. So reenacting, you know, the social gatherings that aren't about business. And the fact that you're face to face and you're trying to, have conversations around their families and the stuff that goes on in our world today is very, very, very important, John.
Right.
Because being stuck in front of a computer in Zoom for 12 to 13 hours a day, of which everyone that I speak to is going through that, and there's all blurry lines between, you know, week and weekends now, can be very fatiguing.
Yep.
And you want to maintain, you want to get the best, and you want to engage your folks. So the compassion side of it, John, is not to be underrated.
Right, right, absolutely. And obviously, through this period, it is also a great opportunity to tap into the talent that becomes available. A lot of companies are unfortunately going through these unfortunate events of downsizing, furloughs and layoffs, which creates additional opportunities, I guess, for companies like Cinch Homes, where you can now tap into the skill set that just last year there was a war for talent out there. Yeah. And us, you know, me being part of an organization that specializes in, you know, more IT staffing side, you know, we've experienced that, you know, head first through that period. And so just curious to spend, you know, a little bit of time with you to talk about your hiring strategies. How do you select the right talent for your teams? First things first, give us a glimpse into an interview with Richard. What does it look like? Do you get creative with your interviews, or do you keep them pretty traditional? Do you take people to lunch and observe how they order food, or just give us a little bit of a glimpse into that process with you?
No, thank you. I know you couldn't wait to get to this question. It sounded like
absolutely. I love it. That's one of my favorite questions.
You know, I guess right or wrong, most people who come out and interview with me would say it's the toughest and probably most insightful interview that they've been through.
Wow.
And so I've kind of, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you can ask some basic questions, you watch people and, you know, all the credit stuff you spoke about, but here's what I look for. I mean, there's certainly a cultural value of our business, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone is cut out for that. And so I try to find out early on, you know, whether the person has what it takes to be successful in our environment, mm-hmm. because, and I keep going back to an ardent student of life cycles, and you mentioned it earlier on, John. If you've, you know, my career over 35 years has been in startups all the way to companies that have been in decline. I can't profess to know everything, and I absolutely don't say that at all. But having experience of startups, mid-sized companies, companies in growth mode, companies in turnaround mode, and companies who are almost on the edge of bankruptcy, you start to learn some stuff.
Right.
How you plug in and what it takes. All right. So I will definitely begin to probe about, do they have what it takes? Because there are people who can be tremendously successful in each one of those life cycles.
Uh-huh.
The thing for us now, John, is we are looking for, we're looking to double in size in the next 3 to 4 years. So we see what's next. We don't necessarily have all the talent. We like people who have been on the other side. All right, and kind of understand the promised land, but I've got to be able to operate today and get us there, right? But anyway, to answer your question, what I look for is I really look for self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That's my one thing. because you're all, when you're in the, when you're in an interview, we're all marketing ourselves, okay?
Yep.
And I'm sure there's wonderful things on that piece of paper, which are great. And I understand that. But what I look for is a very, very balanced view, right? And so I go down the path of, you know, questioning around the level of self-awareness, right? Which could be, you know, what do you do well? What don't you do so well?
Right.
You know, and I want to see how they react to that.
Yep.
Sometimes the interview will be along the lines of, do they offer up where they failed in their career? I want to see that. There's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, right. That's a big point of the interview process, right? And then I may go on, do they look outside? Do they look outside of themselves, right? How do other people view you and blah, blah, blah. And I'm looking for kind of examples and stories around that.
Mm-hmm.
I look for a curious mindset. You can be the most intellectual person in the world, you know?
Right.
But I look for curiosity, right? I look for a positive mindset, you know? I certainly do. I like people with obviously, they've got to be real and not out there. But I look for people who will always see the opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, I'll look for things like, you know, the clarity of thought, you know, how they view their intention and their objectives in their career, etc. I like people who think outside of the box. So my line of questioning, John, when I start to go down those paths, I look for people to have a really balanced response. I know you're marketing and I know you're great and I see from what you do and so on. But I look for the other side as well. It's when people start to bring the other side up about where they're not so good at, or where they've had particular hiccups in their career, which we've all had.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is what you've learned from that.
Yep.
And of course, their ability to work well with others, you know?
I love that. And for all of our listeners, if you are going to be interviewing with Richard, or if you have an interview scheduled with him, there you go. You guys are welcome. You just got a head start, all kinds of insight into the interview with the CFO of Cinch Homes. But all jokes aside, Richard, I can definitely relate on many levels. And I love what you were talking about as far as, you know, the emotional intelligence, the EQ, you know, obviously all of the great accomplishments and everything is on, you know, that resume that's always exaggerated, always, you know, everything is completely different. But looking at a person from a perspective of how self-aware are you? And, you know, also catching some glimpses of arrogance, I guess, from a standpoint of, are you going to be a great team player? Are you going to be able to, you know, what's the mindset? Team collaboration, working as a group? Or do you have more sights and goals and objectives that are more at individual level? So I think that provides a little bit more of a glimpse into kind of that outlook for, you know, the person that you're interviewing. And also sounds like, based on that conversation with you, you also give them an opportunity to interview you as well. That it's an opportunity to have that dialogue and conversation, engage each other, that, hey, this is, you know, I get an idea of what type of person he is. I get an idea of his leadership style. So I think that's really cool. I love all of those examples that you provided.
And you hit it just right, John. You hit the word about, you know, I guess arrogance in some way. But, you know, for me, the word is ego, right? And
right.
Having seen these, you know, these companies at different life cycles and particularly at the executive level, it could be the death of an executive team. It could be the death of a company.
Oh, yeah.
Quite easy death blow, right?
Yeah.
Knowing when to bring the executive professionals in who kind of have got that subject matter expertise and when they kind of fit in. I get it. You know, there's founder syndrome and it's my baby. And I know, you know, listen, at the end of the day, I look for absolute humility.
Yes.
At the C level, when you have that and you understand you don't have all the answers, but you ask the right questions
mm-hmm.
of the people who are much smarter than you below you.
Yeah.
All right. Magic occurs. Magic occurs, John. And I look for that in my interview process.
I love that. And, you know, I've interviewed hundreds of, you know, executives from various levels of Fortune 100 organizations to smaller startups. And one common denominator that I've also picked up on those that are extremely successful is that almost that vulnerability factor where you are okay showing that, you know, your vulnerabilities, your weaknesses, that you're okay, you know, you're definitely self-aware to admit that you don't know everything, that yes, you're an executive, you're C-level, but you are acting as if, you know, I'm not perfect. I don't know everything and I would never assume stuff. So I love those conversations. And sounds like, you know, a lot of the things you talk about is you interview peers within your organization or whoever is going to be part of your division. It's, you know, it's great. It's great. Thanks for those examples.
Absolutely, John. Absolutely.
So in terms of very niche skill set or high demand skill set in your space in finance or even, you know, as an industry in general for you guys as an organization, what would you say are those, you know, the most in demand these days? And how do you go about actually spotting people that possess those types of skills as you get a chance to interview them? Because interview is just a very short conversation, even if it's multiple. There's got to be some strategies that you have in place that help you identify, like, yes, this person has that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things here, John. It crosses the realm of technical expertise because, you know, you're in the IT staffing space. So for us, on a digital transformation, I'm sure you're inundated with requests for, we need people who are going to help us with our digital transformation and mobile technologies. And we're no different than that. So those are, you know, diamonds all over the place, right? And so for us, where we're headed is we can't get enough of those. Mm-hmm. I would say with the amount of bits and bytes of data we have for the size of company we are, you know, again, this is probably a theme that's across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, we need more business analysts and data scientists. And I don't mean business analysts as in the kind of IT sense. Right. I'm talking about folks who can crunch and correlate and provide insights to all this level of data. Mm-hmm. All right, because we have multitude of factors here. We're a very complex business, John, when you start to peel the onion. Yep. Not only is it, the top line revenue stream, which could be by various channels, which have different marketing methods. All right. We have, you know, implications for different billing methods. In our claims, we can slice and dice claims by parts, labor, repair, replace, items, sub-zero, refrigerator. There's a bunch of ways we have to look at this. And so being able to kind of mine that data and provide the insights for us, and it's not typical of finance and accounting. Mm-hmm. It's not income statement, you know, projections and stuff like that. I'm talking about key drivers. I'm talking about where are cancel rates going, where are enrollments going, right, where are you know, loss ratios around claims. It's stuff like that, right? So we are, you know, highly deficient in that, which then leads me to more of a discrete area, which we've always struggled a little bit in the past, but I've noticed that we've had more success is really around the actuarial area. And that's a discrete actuarial type function because we're in the quasi-insurance business. But I think we've had more success around that. Here's where I would say is a big ticket item for us, where the company is looking to move agile and, you know, has a multitude of initiatives, John, mm-hmm. is project managers. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about PMO people. I'm talking about good PMO people.
I love that because that's my background. That's, you know, career-wise, that's where I got started. That's where I grew up professionally in project management, PMO. And, you know, I love what you're talking about as far as really the value that the PMO or the project managers bring to the table is to be able to corral and kind of bring the troops together and keep things organized and moving in the right direction. So, and it goes hand in hand with a lot of the things that you were talking about throughout this interview, throughout this conversation, is really finding those types of people that can do that. So, I love that.
Absolutely. And being it, because we've had some successes, we've had some failures, like every other business around that particular position. Because again, when you think of parts of our business which are very mature and some of it which is very entrepreneurial and immature, mm-hmm. the right person's got to come in and understand that this isn't necessarily a black book with boundaries. Right. And you've got to check this stuff. And we've seen guys who've come in with the playbook around project management and the certifications, and they can't manage change. This is a change process. You got to bring people along with you and for them to understand. And so there may be milestones and, mm-hmm. you know, change, right? Maybe an iterative process. To your point, at this level, one of the biggest challenges in companies of our level are looking to grow and double is companies tend to go very, very vertical, and they do a good job in terms of managing vertically. But, you know, under the sea level where the work really gets done when you're trying to move quickly, it's horizontally and it's a matrix, cross-functional. Aaron, so the skill of the project manager to corral and bring those, bring those teams together and being able to, you know, have the discipline behind the project plan, as the measurements and the KPIs, and understand progress and where the issues and the risks are, and be able to be transparent and raise those, is a really, I tell you, it's a skill that, you know, I know is a dime a dozen. Is a dime a dozen.
Right. Absolutely. And that's, you know, I completely agree with you from that standpoint. And it's also, you know, aside from all of the technical domain expertise in particular area, is really finding somebody who is, you know, genuinely interested in contributing as a team member, versus, you know, versus putting your personal goals as the top priority, as the main objective for joining a particular organization, because then obviously those objectives and goals will trump those of the, you know, the team that you're going to be on. So that's very important. And, you know, sounds like a lot of the different skill sets that you guys are adding to your teams is something within those lines. So definitely great points. Richard, in closure, you have your own podcast.
Yes.
And you and I briefly talked about this. Tell us a little bit about that. And what's the motivation behind it? And I've listened to a couple of episodes, and, you know, by no means I'm no financial expert. And I was actually hoping maybe, you know, through the next series of conversations with you, we can get to a little bit more of a kind of on a personal level, some advice as a CFO, not only of your organization, but as a CEO of your, you know, your household or your personal life, some of the advice that you would give to your younger self. So just tell us a little bit more about your podcast. What's it all about?
Oh, thank you, John, for the plug. I appreciate that.
Of course.
Listen, it's been, I started the podcast about, you know, I think it was February of this year. It really is just a side hobby. So I'm wondering, because my boys have elbowed me, because we've got a very tight South Florida business community. You know, there's always a lot of networking functions and panel functions. And I've really enjoyed being a moderator on these panels. And people have kind of come back and said, wow, you asked some really good questions. So my boys and my wife have always looked at that and said, you know, you need to do your own podcast. Mm-hmm. It really is away from the typical kind of business scripted type of things. I tried to go a little bit deeper. To build a tribe of conscious leaders, all right? It's really, you know, the emerging type of leaders and stuff that us folks are probably a little bit more seasoned, have had scar tissue around, that you try to bring these wisdom bites to the podcast. So I take various topics around that. I try to bring some experts and people who are willing to impart those wisdom bites. And, you know, I try to bring perhaps a next level of depth in the conversation. And I take that very seriously. And as I've moderated panels before, then that's one thing people said, you don't have these scripted questions, whether it's around the topic or not. You tend to go a bit further and on topics that may, you know, interest the audience, or so you go a little bit further. So what I would say, it's really, it's called Prepare for Growth. It's on, you know, all of the you know, major, you know, podcast platforms.
Awesome.
It's about, you know, building a tribe of conscious leaders and interconnected learners, you know.
I love it. And for our listeners,
variety of topics there, you know.
Oh, that's great. And for our listeners, we'll definitely link to Richard's podcast in the episode notes. Definitely check it out. Give him a shout out, give him a listen, and give him some 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Richard, last but not least, question I asked everybody is, what are you currently reading, and what is one book that you always recommend to others, and why?
What I'm currently reading is called The Intelligence Trap. And it's a research from the UK. It's a lovely book. And it really talks about, you know, how we've kind of got it wrong about how we measure intelligence with IQ. Mm-hmm. It starts to go through how, and it starts with a study of, you know, kids who have just basically blew out the IQ test when they're younger and followed their lives over the years. And some of them made it and some of them didn't. And it starts to go into the reasons why, you know, just having, you know, a score like the IQ process is not the total picture. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned EQ and you mentioned, you know, some of the traps that we all fall into in terms of intelligence, whether we have enough curiosity or we tend to, you know, ruminate on our own point of view, etc. So that's one of the books I'm reading. But Your question, on the other hand, was you know, what do I recommend, right? I've got a list of them, but you asked for one, right?
Yeah.
So I have to skinny the list down because I love to read stuff.
Right.
But the one book I love to read and I love to recommend is one of my most favorite questions, John, when you have employee issues. And 100% of the time in my 35 years of being in the business world, people will come to me and say, you know, I don't get along with Sally. Sally's not doing this. Tom's not doing that. This one's not doing that. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I can't do this and I can't do that. And I ask them one question. And 100% of the time, John, they respond with like a deer in headlights.
Uh-huh.
One question I simply ask is, how might you have contributed to the situation? And I let it settle for 5 seconds, John, because I tell you what, 100% of the time people say, who, me? No, I'm not the issue. Sally's the issue. Tom's the issue. No, how can it be me? I see it my way.
I love it.
I see it my way. No. Or they go speechless because they never thought about looking at themselves.
Right. Right?
And so the one book I would recommend to anyone is called Leadership and Self-Deception by the Binger Institute.
Love it.
And what that book does, it tells us how to get out of the box. Mm-hmm. Why is there conflict? Whether it's at home, you know, friendships, nations, wars, or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there conflict? It's because we simply don't see ourselves as equals with the other side, right? We simply don't try to put ourselves in the shoes of other people. We rather see ourselves above or below, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this book tells us about how we get, and it gives very real life examples of, you know, husband and wife and parents, and gives you all kind of examples of, and it's set in a kind of parable way, right? But it starts to talk about how we get into the box very simply and we forget to look at ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two other volumes of that. There's the leadership one I mentioned, and then there's the outward mindset, and then there's the anatomy of peace. Those are three with, you know, that are basically written by the Arvinger Institute. But the first one I recommend to anyone in business. Because then you look at yourself in the mirror. Maybe I'm part of the problem. Maybe I'm the problem.
Of course. Usually that's not the first route. It's never me. I love that recommendation. I'm definitely going to check it out myself with my growing list of books that I need to read. Richard, thank you so much for your lent expertise to us today, packed with great insights. I definitely, you know, you and I are going to stay in touch and possibly record another episode sometime soon. Appreciate your time and stay in touch, and thank you for everything.
You've been very gracious, John, and thank you. Very insightful questions and the way you probed a bit further, but the pleasure's all mine. It's an honor. And thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.